Thank you.
Like to open a subcommittee on the House Committee on Consumer Protection for Monday, May 18th. While we await a quorum, I would like to announce that Senate Bill 386A, if you're here for that, we are carrying that bill over to Wednesday. We have several bills up for work session, and the subcommittee will open a work session on Senate Bill 623.
How did we do that? I thought we were down a minute.
As we left this bill, Representative Wingard, you had a question with the PUC on that bill that you wanted answered. Did you get that bill answered to your satisfaction, or that question?
I believe we got an email, Mr. Chair, from the PUC answering that question, saying that, in fact, they did have the ability to do this internally through their rules-making process. My memory serves. I think everyone got that email, not just me.
Was it to your satisfaction?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So with that, we will stand at ease. Great. I'm going to reconvene the subcommittee on the House Committee on Consumer Protection, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 205. Victoria, give us a brief summary of 205, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. Senate Bill 205 specifies type of work on a residential structure or zero lot line dwelling that is subject to written contract and clarifies applicability of contract cancellation terms. Expands warranty offer requirement to include newly constructed residential structure or zero lot line dwelling sold by contractor. Adds original purchaser to persons receiving consumer notice form. Specifies time for contractor to provide recommended maintenance schedule. Eliminates requirement that construction contractors board make recommended maintenance payment schedule information available without charge. Committee, if you'll recall, this bill was voted out of the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs, 401, and passed on the Senate floor, 2901. We have dash 1 and dash 2 amendments. Dash 1 changes the one-day contract cancellation to a period of 3 days, and dash 2 requires the contractor to provide the maintenance schedule at the same time as the warranty offer is made.
Mr. Chair, I'm ready to vote on this bill.
Yes.
That was fun.
Maybe we don't have anybody signed up, obviously, but could we have Craig Smith come forward on this one?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board. How can I help you today?
And maybe we can get Scott Berry to come up, and he probably won't help us, but he'll provide some conversation. I just wanted to check in with you on this. I know you spent a bit of time explaining this bill to us. The committee came back with a couple of amendments, one of which, or both of which, the administrator has now explained a little bit. I was wondering if you had any feedback on those potential amendments.
Mr. Chair, I can tell you that I've had no in-depth conversations with the board. We really haven't met since these came out. I have given this to staff, and I can tell you that we could administer the law the way this is written. In both cases, they're not huge changes from an administration standpoint. The little bit that I've mentioned this to my friends in industry, they may have some comments about that, about the policy choices there. But I don't plan on entering into that unless drug kicking and screaming.
Thank you. Mr. Berry, welcome to the work session of this subcommittee. Would you like to comment on the two proposed amendments we have to Senate Bill 205?
Sure. Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association. I really just had time to kind of hand engross the dash ones in, and I'm looking at the dash twos right now, and I haven't seen these up until this very moment, or about 5 minutes ago. So I would say, to start with, as on the Senate side, we were very supportive of Senate Bill 205. However, the dash ones, I do believe our folks will have some concerns with. This was an issue addressed by the Construction Claims Task Force, and at the point where they began addressing this particular issue, along with many others, there was no waiting period on these contracts. After quite a bit of discussion, they compromised on 1 day. The far other end was this 3-day amendment that you see in the dash ones. So having seen this for the first time today since the claims task force, I know our folks on the task force had concerns about it then. I would assume those concerns are still in place. And I know there is a 3-day waiting period for some folks who go around kind of traveling around through a neighborhood and ask you if you want new siding put on your house, that sort of thing. That's a 3-day waiting period. In a scenario where the contact is started by the consumer, calling a contractor, having them come out, take a look, walk through the potential project, whether it's a new home or or just a remodel project, that currently is 1 day or 24 hours, and we would support the continuation of that 24 hours. For new construction, I'll just leave it at that.
So I have a couple of questions, and I'd probably like both of you to address the question. I believe our conversation and testimony, even from last session, we found that the remodeling contracts required or had a 3-day period, and new home sales also have a 3-day period. So it didn't seem consistent. And from our recollection of reviewing the Construction Claims Task Force last session, I don't believe our conversation was to exempt the custom homes to a one day, and it was felt by the members that that 3-day period should be consistent for remodeling projects and new home purchases as well. So it seemed like a more of a consistency. It seemed odd that the custom homes would be the only one with a one-day period. And Mr. Smith, can you comment on that? I mean,
sure.
Did we hear testimony incorrectly? Is that currently the state that the custom home contracts are the only ones with a one-day time period?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, Craig Smith. There's a law that's called the home solicitation, commonly 3-day rescission clause, and that may be a little bit of a bad title because it sounds like it has something to do with selling homes. But it's for is for contracts that are negotiated outside the scope of the person's business. And commonly it's for vacuum cleaners, home improvements, anything's, you know, peddled door to door. And then that was extended, I think you recall that testimony that we gave, to things that are negotiated at the fair. So it isn't necessarily just in the home. It's for contracts. And what's happened in the past is you get some pretty high pressure sales tactics when you kind of get excited as a consumer, and you need a little bit of time to think about that. I think that's the public policy for the 3-day rescission clause that are in most of those types of contracts, and it's a very aggressive law. I think if you don't have the right language in the contract, the law is still there, and it's a very good piece of consumer legislation. It has to do with both there's a federal law as well as a state law that kicks in. I don't believe that law affects new home construction. And if you heard that, or if Kathleen Dolling may have said words to that effect, she may have been in error. And if you heard that, that may not be correct. Matter of fact, I'm almost positive, and I questioned her a little bit after the hearing because I thought I heard something like that when she testified. I was a little concerned about that and asked her to check with that. So if we have misled you regarding the new home sales and a 3-day rescission clause being invoked there for any type of a new home sale, I don't believe that's accurate, and I'd have to go back and double check. I'll be happy to address the committee on that point because I do not believe that new homes have a 3-day rescission right, whether it's custom or specialty or spec homes. However, home improvement contracts that are negotiated, again, in any place other than the seller's place of business, which would include when somebody comes to your house and wants to offer to put in a swimming pool or a new home addition or anything like that, those do have 3-day rescission rights included, and there's quite a bit of law on that.
So can you explain the reasoning for allowing a 3-day rescission on a remodel project but not on a custom home contract?
Right. I wasn't around, Mr. Chair, when all those laws were passed, but let me take a stab at it from working in the industry a little bit. Again, the rationale for a 3-day right of cooling off is that when a contract is negotiated in the heat of the moment and there's fairly significant salesmanship involved, sometimes folks can make a decision in haste that after 3 days they get a chance to think about their decision and they ought to have a right to change their mind. And that's what's happened with remodeling, is some, you know, when it's negotiated there inside the house. Now with a custom home product, you know, I think the right for a consumer to change their mind, that's a policy decision, and I've heard some comments that, you know, why not? Why not give a right to change your mind? And that would be something that, you know, it's a good question, and that's my response.
I'd like to close the subcommittee and open the full committee on House Committee on Consumer Protection. Representative Riley.
I'll let you answer after I ask this question because it's the same, basically. My question is, why would, and I'm going to ask the same question you just said some people do. Why would we give someone a 3-day right of rescission on a new cabinet and not on the most expensive thing they ever buy in their life?
Again, Scott Barrett, the Oregon Home Builders, and I believe. Just to clarify, at least my understanding of the statute is that remodel projects have a 1-day, just like new construction has a 1-day, just like the having somebody do a custom home has a 1-day right of rescission today. The home solicitation, whether that's the right term or not, is the 3-day. So cabinets in your house, I assume you're going to the cabinet maker, the cabinet shop, the remodeler's place of business to design those cabinets, have them designed and put in your house. That's all under the current 1-day right of rescission. So I just wanted to clarify that remodel projects are 1-day right of rescission as well as new construction. And it's only that home solicitation, again, right term or not, it's only the home solicitation that is the 3-day according to the statute. And I can read that right now if you'd like me to. It says, a property owner who enters into an initial written contract for the construction improvement or repair, so construction improvement or repair of a residential structure or zero lot line dwelling on real property owned by the property owner, may cancel the contract by delivery of written notice prior to midnight at the end of the next business day. So.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that clarity. It seems like we were operating under some other assumptions. And I believe when you buy a house, you know, through a realtor, for example, that you have 3 days to think about it when you buy a house.
A lot longer than that, actually. Yeah. I'm there with Oregon Home Builders, and I'm not sure on the realtor understanding. I know in most cases you've got earnest money agreements that go into effect immediately, and those can be, you know, canceled with the small penalty of the earnest money, depending on where you are in the process of a home purchase, whether it's new or existing. But mm-hmm. That would be a question probably for the realtors.
Heather.
Having been a realtor, yeah. Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
Thank you. There are actually, you know, lots of different ways that earnest money contracts can be written, lots of different ways that purchase contracts for new homes can be written. And, yeah, there's usually several days of when, you know, people are thinking about it one way or the other. Yeah, it's kind of hard to pin down on the real estate transactions what that actual time is. Would you agree with that?
Chair Holby and Representative Riley, I would. It depends, and that's again true with going in and touring and buying a new house. There's a long period there where that can be stopped.
So now that we've talked about that for a little bit, Mr. Berry, on the -2 amendments. Let me give you an opportunity to speak to that one.
Thank you.
Since you're sitting there in the seat. This is the one that had to do with the maintenance schedule, and I think the proposed bill from the Senate proposed, and Mr. Smith can probably articulate this better, but required you to get that maintenance schedule at the end of the project, and this committee, I think, felt that that maintenance schedule should be presented at the time the warranty is offered, so people can, because it has something to do with whether or not you're going to be able to perfect your warranty, has to do with whether you're performing the maintenance schedule that's required in the with the home builder. So it seems like it's part of the contract and should be up front. That
sure.
That was our concern. I'm just kind of curious on your perception of that.
Yeah, and Chair Hovey again, Scott Barry with the Oregon Home Builders. You know, I know that this is a fairly new law in the first place in terms of the maintenance schedule, but I know our folks, as this law has been put into place, have those maintenance schedules. I don't know the downside of showing that maintenance schedule to the homeowner as they see the warranty. It seems to make sense to me. I guess I would be somewhat concerned if we were talking about a large civil penalties for handing a large amount of information and the maintenance schedule not being there, although I think asking the maintenance schedule be there with the warranty certainly makes sense.
Did we leave the penalties out?
Chair Hovey, I've not perused the amendment. I again just finished the dash ones and hadn't gotten to the dash twos yet when I came up.
Thank you for reminding us.
Craig, obviously you haven't had time to present this to your board. I'm not going to ask you whether they would see any problems with this or not, but from your perception, is there a issue? I think you testified that you'd be able to implement this if it were to pass.
Chair Holby, and members of the committee, that's correct. We could implement this. This would be a matter of training. I think that there's a question about civil penalties. Just so you know that, you know, any law that you pass here, the board would have civil penalty authority over, and we'd of course work with all interested parties to develop what that penalty structure might be. But we would of course, as in all new laws, make sure folks understand what it is before we'd be looking at any kind of enforcement. And so the bottom line is we could administer the SB 205 as written or with the dash 2 amendments. Though I hesitate to go in these troubled waters, I'd like to try to go back if I can and talk a little bit about 205, because I don't want the record to be unclear. 205 has to do with whether it's a one-day rescission or 3-day, and in some cases, both laws might apply. I don't want there to be any question about that. What matters, even if you pass this law, is where the contract is negotiated. The 3-day right of rescission would be there if it is a contract that's negotiated in some place other than the seller's office. And so if I, as a contractor, were to come to a home and sell the job there at your home, for example, that 3-day right of rescission would be there, as well as the 1-day.
Thank
both
you.
Would apply.
Thank you. Committee, I think after listening to some further clarification, I don't know that I want to move the dash one amendment at this time. It might be something for the committee to entertain during the interim and have a little more discussion on that concept. However, I think the dash two amendment is good. If I have the support of the committee, I think I'd entertain a motion on the dash 2 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Riley.
I move the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 205.
Representative Riley moves the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 205. Discussion? Not seeing any discussion. Cindy, could we have a roll call vote?
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative
Callan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Absent.
Representative Krieger?
Excused.
Representative Matthews?
Excused.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative
Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Excused.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair
Holby? Aye. The dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 205, having received the required votes, is passed. Senator Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 205 is amended to the floor as a task recommendation.
Representative Riley moves Senate Bill 205 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Not seeing any. Cindy, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Callan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Absent.
Representative Krieger?
Excused.
Representative Matthews?
Excused.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Excused.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 205, having received the required votes, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Carrier? Representative Riley? Carry the bill. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 205. I get to go back to the agenda. That, I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 623. Victoria, you want to give us a brief summary of the bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 623 directs the Public Utility Commission to allow higher water rates for metered water systems serving fewer than 500 customers. It passed out of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation 5-0, passed the Senate floor 25-4-1. There are no conflicts, and it's ready to move.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 623 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves Senate Bill 623 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Winger.
I did ask a question previously on this bill about whether it was necessary and whether or not the Public Utility Commission could move forward on their own. We all received a letter in response. And if you permit me 60 seconds to read
absolutely.
The key element of this. Short answer to Representative Winger's question is yes. We believe that the change can be made in rule based on this statutory language. However, we understand the sponsor of this bill felt that a change in the statute would give clear direction and ensure that the higher rate threshold is not changed in some future rulemaking. As a result of that, I will be a no vote, as I don't believe that it's necessary.
Thank you. Senator Riley.
Mr. Chair, I am going to withdraw my motion.
Representative Riley has moved to withdraw his motion. I would like to suspend the rules to allow us to withdraw the motion for now. Is there any objection to that? The motion is withdrawn, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 623. Back as soon as you can.
Okay.
And here we go to the next lovely bill. Like to. Which one do you want to do next? You want to go to 771? With that, I am going to reopen the subcommittee on the House Committee on Consumer Protection and open a work session on Senate Bill 771A.
Belongs to you, man.
Victoria, give us a brief summary of the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 771A revises certain provisions for termination of tenancy, allows for a 30-day no-cause notice of termination by tenant in month-to-month tenancy, allows for a 30-day no-cause notice of termination by landlord within the first year of month-to-month tenancy, allows for a 60-day no-cause notice of termination by landlord after the first year of month-to-month tenancy, allows but does not require statement of reason for termination in the notice, allows temporary occupancy agreement and specifies parties who may be subject to agreement, delineates procedures and parameters for temporary occupancy agreement, delineates procedures for disposition of personal property of deceased tenant, limits types of fees landlords may charge, and requires that landlords provide tenants with written list of fees, prohibits landlords for charging fee or deposit for assistance animals, specifies allowable fees related to tenant damage or abandonment of rental housing. This bill was voted out of the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs 5-0. pass the floor 28-2. You should have dash A for amendments in front of you.
Thank you. And I believe we would like to have somebody come up and walk through those, or for my benefit, maybe review Senate Bill 771, John Van Landingham. Seeing how I left at our last encounter before this bill came up, and I don't know if we had the A4 amendments at that point either.
Mr. Chair, John Van Landingham, Lane County Legal Aid. I believe that my testimony made you sick and you had to go home. So I'm giving you the same testimony, that a written testimony that I gave out Wednesday in the public hearing on this, just because some of you weren't here. So if you were here, there's nothing new in that. It hasn't changed. One thing I do want to correct that Victoria said, I believe that the Senate vote was 28 yes, 2 absent. So there hasn't been a no vote yet on this bill, although there's always the first.
In this committee, that's a good assumption.
So there are amendments. The dash 4 amendments include the dash 3. The dash 4 amendments make two changes at the request of landlords. Landlords and realtors who wanted us to make a change that worked better for them, and the other for Section 8 landlords that make something work better for them. So both of the changes in the dash 4 amendments are to favor landlords. The bill itself covers four issues. It's a product of the General Landlord Tenant Coalition, the other coalition, not the Manufactured Housing Coalition. That group meets separately. It has about 18 active members, 10 of whom are landlords, 6 of whom are tenant representatives. The landlords represent both large and mom-and-pop landlords, three statewide groups. We met 18 times, three hours per meeting. So we worked this quite a bit. There are four issues covered in the bill. Those four are changing no-cause notices after the first year. Under current Oregon law, a landlord can terminate a tenancy on a 30-day no-cause notice. Don't have to state a reason. There are no defenses to it unless the landlord does it wrong or unless the landlord's real motive, underlying motive a tenant can prove, is discrimination or retaliation. So what we've done in this particular issue is borrowed a concept from California, which is to say that after 1 year of occupancy, a landlord cannot use a 30-day no-cause notice. The landlord would have to use a 60-day no-cause notice. We've made an exception there for real estate purchases. That's covered in the Dash 4 amendment. So if there's a real estate sale and the purchaser intends to live there, that purchaser would not have to give a 60-day notice, could give a 30-day notice. The intent from the tenant perspective is that it's hard for tenants to find a place to move in only 30 days and to gather the deposits required and to organize the kids in school and all that sort of thing. So that's the 60-day notice issue. The second issue in the bill is something we've called a temporary occupant agreement, and we're creating what I've referred to as a super guest. Guests are not defined in the Landlord-Tenant Act. That's partly because the two sides can't agree on how to define them and what rights they have or don't have. But a guest is clearly not a tenant, and tenants clearly have the right to invite some guests. Landlords frequently have time limits, and they say that after a certain amount of time, if there's a guest, then that's a violation by the tenant, and the tenant can be evicted for having guests that are too long. Both sides agree, both landlords and tenants agree, that in some cases it's good to have longer-term guests. And an example might be a son who is living with a parent and helping the parent in some way. We're not talking about caregivers, because caregivers are not treated as tenants. They're treated as employees. In fact, you had a bill earlier that made an exception for caregivers in terms of landlord-tenant situations. But what we want to do here is create this temporary occupant status for a super guest, define what their rights are, define how the tenant removes them, define what the landlord does if the temporary occupant violates the rules. So that's the purpose of the second issue covered. The third issue has to do with the abandoned property of a dead tenant or a tenant who dies living alone. Landlords are required now to store abandoned property. Abandoned property means any property left in the rental unit after the tenancy ends. The law requires the landlord to store it, to give written notice to the tenant, wait a certain number of days. If the tenant doesn't contact the landlord or claim the property, the landlord has to either sell it or, if it's worth not very much money, throw it away.
Just a minute, please. Sorry. I'd like to close the subcommittee on the House Committee on Consumer Protection and open the full committee on the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
So what we've done here, in this particular case, where the tenant lives alone and dies, there's no one to claim the property. Landlords don't want to go through a long process with regard to that stuff, but they would like to see that it gets to the rightful claimant, an heir or a personal representative, or in many cases, landlords have rental agreement forms that require the tenant to designate a person who can claim the stuff if the tenant dies. That person doesn't rise to the status of being a personal representative or an heir, but has some claim to it. So we've created in this statute a process for those people to make claims. We worked with the Division of State Lands, to as part of their mission of protecting consumer rights, to make sure that that process works well. There's a written notice that would go to the heirs, the personal representative, the designated person, and to the Division of State Lands. And Division of State Lands has the right to come in, look at the property, make sure that it goes to any claimant, rightful claimant, and if not, take it for the state. The last issue covered has to do with fees and deposits. Deposits are defined as money that the tenant pays towards on the tenancy to secure performance, and the tenant is entitled to get that money back or to get an accounting describing how the landlord used it. Fees are not required to be accounted for. So a landlord can charge a fee, and you don't ever get that money back. And you don't get an accounting for it either. I wrote the fee statute through the coalition several years ago. I'd have to say that I did a bad job. It doesn't work very well. Tenant advocates have found an example of 30 different fees that landlords have been charging, a number of them for things that we think are inappropriate. So what the coalition has done here is limit the use of fees by landlords to specific examples and broaden the ability of landlords to use the deposit. For example, it isn't clear under current law that landlords can charge against the deposit their own time in cleaning a rental unit. So the new statute will make that clear that the landlord can do that. Those are the four issues. I'd be glad to answer questions. That's probably a lot more than people wanted to know anyway.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate you walking through that for me. If nothing else, I apologize to the committee if they've already heard some of that. See any questions on this amendment or the bill? This time we're in work session, and I'd entertain a motion to adopt the -4 amendment.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Riley,
move the A4 amendment to Senate Bill 771A.
Representative Riley moves the -4 amendment to Senate Bill 771A. Is there discussion? Cindy, can I have a roll call vote, please, on the -4 amendment?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Absent.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Excused.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Excused.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. The -4 amendments are adopted to Senate Bill 771A, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 771A as we're awaiting fiscal. And with that, I would like to suspend the rules on what bill was it we passed earlier? Senate Bill. I would like to suspend the rules to allow Representative Krieger to vote on Senate Bill
205,
which was the construction contractor zero lot line. Representative Krieger, we adopted the -2 amendment, but not the -1.
Okay. Give me just about a second.
Can have a couple.
And what does the 2 do? Means I wasn't here.
Anyway, let me make sure. Was there any objection to suspending the rules? Okay, then we will
open the work session back up on Senate Bill 205 to allow Representative Krieger to vote. And is Craig Smith still here? Yeah. Can't
just a quick
Victoria.
The Dash 2 amendments require the contractor to provide the maintenance schedule at the same time that the warranty is offered.
Okay, that's simple enough.
No objection.
Yeah, that's fine,
Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Krieger, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Krieger votes aye. Three. Let the record show that. And so I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 205. That I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 929A. Victoria, please give us a brief summary of Senate Bill 929.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 929A requires manufactured dwelling park landlord to use submetering as billing method when landlord assesses tenant utility or service charge for water. Requires compliance by January 2nd, 2012. Limits the application of measure to manufactured dwelling parks with 200 or more spaces. You should have Dash A4 and Dash A5 amendments in front of you, which were both delivered at the beginning of the hearing.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you. Do we have anybody to speak to those bills?
I think Don Miner will speak to the A4s, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me?
I think Don Miner would speak to the A4s.
Okay. Mr. Miner.
Thank you, Chair Holby, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. We're the requesters of the Dash A4 amendments. Before we brought that to you, before the committee, we went and spoke with the Senator Bonamici about it, and she was agreeable to this amendment. What it does is provide an extra building season for a park owner to convert to submeters. That'll give him give the builder June, July, and August, maybe September of 12. Remember that the bill itself only applies to larger parks. The park that we were concerned with is about a 500-plus space park. So is just the logistics involved with getting this done.
So you're extending the date essentially a year?
Yes, slightly less.
Basically,
yeah, 2 days less. Yes,
slightly less. So I appreciate that. Are there any questions on that?
Down there,
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Miner. Thank you for bringing the amendment forward. My question is why. I gather you feel that year is necessary to the park. I mean, but it's 2012, and they already have this building season. Mm-hmm. 2010 and 2011. Mm-hmm. Why is 2012 necessary?
During the testimony on the bill itself, mm-hmm. statements were made that at least a goal of this was to use it to leverage. The bill itself was aimed at a park owner. Not park owners, plural, a park owner, although it has wide application now, and that it was hopefully could be used during the interim by the coalition and by the 2011 session to change behavior, maybe is the way of saying it, and that there was some expectation that, in fact, the bill would be modified in the 11th session. And so that our testimony during the hearing was that a person thinking that that would occur would at least wait until January of 11 to start working on this proposal. And so they wouldn't have, in fact, this or 10.
Brief follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you. I first of all, I appreciate that. And
That does make some sense. I do just dispute the assumption that this bill is in response to a park owner. I think you're referring specifically at the risk of, I guess I can't engage in libel in my official capacity, but with the Heritage Park. However, I believe there's also, for example, I can think of one in my district, Big Valley Woods, which is actually a separate owner that has had similar issues. Okay. This bill would also apply to them. Mm-hmm. And I'm reluctant to delay. I think 3 years is ample time, okay. At least initially. I'm still concerned.
But if I could just answer, some of you weren't here for our testimony, but the way the law works is that 771, the coalition's main bill, 772, provides that you can't do a rent increase 1 year prior to submetering. An existing law in Chapter 90, and I don't have my note with me, provides that you can't raise the rent 1 year after you submeter. So a question arises, where does the capital come from to perform this labor? Capital markets are difficult now.
Mm-hmm.
There's at least a year and a half time frame where you can't raise the rent to secure the funds to do the work. And so there's that issue. Our assumption is that the bill is going to go forward. I think that if this committee passes this piece of legislation, a prudent landlord who has more than 200 spaces must assume that it will not be repealed or modified by a subsequent legislature. So they have to go forward. And so this also then provides an opportunity to raise revenues to do the work, provides a couple of building seasons, an extra building season to get the work done.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger.
Don, as I recall, we heard figures of $140 to $400 per hookup could be in the range depending on how far of a space you're taking up pavement. A 300 or 400 unit thing could be a pretty sizable investment. And why you had it tore up, you may even want to do other things. It means you've already got into it that far. Other improvements means you're already getting it to that far. So I think the idea of giving a little more time, Mr. Chair, does make some sense, because the money's got to come from someplace.
Yeah, clearly there's, I'm a little concerned about the time, but, I can kind of understand some of it. But we don't have the paperwork to move this bill right now, and before I would adopt this amendment, I want a chance for Representative Barton and myself and perhaps Representative Krieger to talk to Senator Bonamici on this. This is her bill, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
To go over this time frame a little bit. I am a little bit concerned about the length of time. I understand it would be nice, for that aspect of it, but it does seem to me like a long period of time. So I'd like to have that opportunity, since we don't have the paperwork to move the bill, to discuss this offline a little bit.
If I may make one more remark. Normally when the legislature changes a building code or a development standard, those developments that are existing in. So this is a substantial departure. The parks that we're speaking to here are parks that complied with the law at the time they were built. So if for no other reason than that we're changing the ground rules somewhat retroactively, that may be another justification for an additional increment of time.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony on that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Van Landingham, were you prepared to testify on this particular bill? Or did you have any input on this particular issue?
I'd answer questions. I testified previously. John Brennan and I testified that we were neutral.
Okay, thanks.
And we expect the coalition to work the issue.
Thank you. With that, I'm going to close the...
Mr. Chair, before you close, would you like me to talk at all about the A5s, or do you just want to move on?
Oh, the A5s. Certainly. Didn't see the A5. Oh, there they are. Sorry. Briefed over them. Go ahead. If Representative Wingard, you'd like to address that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I asked Legislative Council to draft the A5s based on the conversation in committee on the bill last week. It was my sense that the bill, the issue behind the bill was water leakage, and I was concerned that we were casting a rather wide net and that we might be putting a lot of costs into these mobile home parks, which in turn would be reflected in the rates. And because I didn't want to see a rather expansive bill that might lead to rate increases for the tenants in some places where it might be completely unnecessary, I thought a better way to get at this would be simply provide a mechanism for tenants of large parks who believe that there is water leakage going on and that that's being passed on to them to petition the water utility company to investigate that and order the, if there is a substantial leak going on, to order the owner to fix the problem. So what the A5 amendment does is essentially gut the bill and remove all the mandates that were in there about metering and instead allow tenants in a mobile home park, 50 of them, at least 50 of them, to sign a petition that would be held confidential so the owner would never know who signed that petition, and that once that they had those 50 signatures, the local water utility would investigate for leaks, and if they found substantial leaks, then the owner would be required to fix those leaks.
Thank you. Any other discussion? And yes,
Mr. Chair, have those amendments or that amendment been distributed?
Yes, you should have it in front of you.
Oh, A5 right there. Thank you, sir.
Any other discussion on this? Now I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 929, and we're going to stand at ease.
in order to reopen. Oh.
Okay.
Excuse me. I'd like to reopen the House Committee on Consumer Protection. And, committee, I'd like to suspend the rules so we can reopen Senate Bill 771A. We just received the fiscal on it. And is there any objection to suspending the rules so we can work that bill?
671.
771A. Different bill.
Yes. And it came out of the Senate 28.
Victoria, you want to briefly review it? For Senator Krieger wasn't here, wouldn't we?
Sure. Senate Bill 771A revises certain provisions for termination of tenancy, allows for 30-day no-cause notice of termination by tenant in month-to-month tenancy, allows for a 30-day no-cause notice of termination by landlord within first year of month-to-month tenancy, allows for 60-day no-cause notice of termination by landlord after first year of month-to-month tenancy, allows but does not require a statement of reason for termination in notice, allows temporary occupancy agreement and specifies parties who may be subject to agreement, delineates procedures and parameters for temporary occupancy agreement, delineates procedures for disposition of personal property of deceased tenant, limits types of fees landlord may charge, and requires that landlord provide tenant with a written list of fees, prohibits landlord from charging fees or deposit for assistance animals, specifies allowable fees related to tenant damage or abandonment of rental housing. This was voted out of the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs 5-0 and passed the Senate 28-02.
And we have adopted the Dash 4 amendments. Correct. And
yes.
Would you explain to Representative Krieger briefly what the Dash 4 amendments were?
Changes the no-cause notices after the first year, after 1 year, a 60-day notice is required except in cases where the unit has been sold. Comes up with a definition of a guest in order to deal with temporary occupancy issues. Sets out a process for disposing of the possessions of a tenant who dies, and specifies which are allowed to be charged as fees, which do not have to be returned nor accounted for, and which are allowed to be charged as deposits, which must be accounted for. So it basically limits the number of fees that can be charged and expands the realm of deposits that can be charged.
Mr. Chair, was there opposition to the bill?
No. We had Mr. Van Landingham, who was up and walked through the bill, and he could certainly come back up and answer any questions for you.
If you tell me that, that's fine.
I don't recall any opposition. Does anyone on the committee have received any opposition to the bill?
Fine.
Representative Gilliam.
Mr. Chair, what is the fiscal? What's the basic report?
No expenditure.
There was no expenditure report. What's that? There was no fiscal expenditure.
We were waiting for one, but they said there is none. Is that what the idea
is? No. We have the report. It is a report of no fiscal.
We have to have the paperwork report before we can move the bill out.
Got it.
Even though it says there isn't any fiscal impact.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Okay. So, hearing no objection to suspending the rules to reopen Senate Bill 771A, I'm opening the work session on Senate Bill 771A as amended, and would entertain a motion on that bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move Senate Bill 771A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves Senate Bill 771A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Cindy, could we have a roll call vote?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative
Callen?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Excused.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Excused.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 771A, having received the required votes, is passed before the due pass recommendation. Carrier for the bill? Volunteers?
All good.
Representative Krieger, thank you very much. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 771A. With that committee, I'm going to stand at ease for just a moment. Reopen the House Committee on Consumer Protection, a committee previously we were in work session on 6/23. I'd like to get unanimous consent to suspend the rules to reopen that work session to enable us to move this bill.
Do we have to suspend the rules, Mr. Chair, to reopen the work session?
On this one, I do, because I suspend the rules to... we have the parliamentarian here. She could answer that question. If I could bring her forward to answer that question for you.
I know Sarah there.
But I believe we do.
Are you objective to
Ramona?
That bill? I just do. What I'm looking at is I can give him a courtesy vote. Because when he gets his other man here,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ramona Kennedy. I'm the chief clerk and parliamentarian for the House. Monitoring the operations of the consumer protection, your chair has gracefully and brought the committee into the process and allowing for the reopening of several work sessions today by asking for a rule suspension. He did that just previously on Senate Bill 771. Therefore, to be consistent with the way he has performed his duties, whether or not it's required or not, as a courtesy to this body and to the committee, he has asked for that to be reopened.
So, Mr. Chair, can I ask her a question?
I'd like to as well, please.
Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is the issue that once you've closed a work session that you posted, that you have to have unanimous consent to reopen it? Is that the...
In the intent of the postings is to provide for notice of what's going to be happening that day in the committee. And there might have been interested parties here who when it closed... The work session may or may not be here now, and therefore, as a courtesy to make sure that the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. However, it was posted appropriately with the appropriate notice. I would suggest that it is not required to ask for the rule suspension. The chair could have moved forward with that out without that permission, but it has been his precedent and his practice to ask for that request.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know why you look at me so suspiciously. I believe it or not, I was trying to do the good chair a favor, of course. I always do. Madam Clerk, thank you. It's delightful to have you with us yet again. I notice you come and visit us more often in this committee than some of our others.
That's because I invite her.
I noticed, the purpose of consistency, I believe, and you probably have a better recollection, that actually he's not previously asked for unanimous consent, but he's asked to suspend the rules.
Correct.
It's only this time he's asked for unanimous consent.
And again...
Do we need unanimous consent to do this?
You do not need unanimous consent. I would suggest you need a rule suspension.
And correct me if
I'm... As a courtesy, as a precedent.
correct me if I'm wrong, will that need seven votes as opposed to...
That is correct. The committee would need seven votes.
I was trying to help you, see, Mr. Chair.
Yes, I was aware of that. Thank you. So, any other questions for the parliamentarian? Now that we have... Thank you very much for helping clarify the...
Don't you dare.
It's just a question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, I've asked for unanimous consent. Is there any objection?
I'm supposed to give you that.
Not seeing any objection. Thank you, committee. I'd like to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 623. Representative Riley, could I entertain a motion on Senate Bill 623?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 623 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Let me correct you. We didn't amend that.
I move Senate Bill 623 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Riley moves Senate Bill 623 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wingard.
I'm going to restate my objection to Senate Bill 623. We, in the previous committee, I did ask the Public Utility Commission if they weren't capable of executing what this bill is asking for through their rules process. We have all received a letter from them saying that they don't need the bill in order to do it. Therefore, I believe it's unnecessary, and I hope my fellow members of the committee will join me in voting no on Senate Bill 623.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments, and as such, I will also note that the Public Utility Commissioner was here in support of this bill and thinking that the clarification in statute would actually help this situation. So I'm compelled to go ahead and move this bill forward. It causes no harm and helps clarify the statute. With that, any other discussion? Cindy, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
No.
Representative Krieger?
Aye. Give me a courtesy vote for now rather than have to wait for Mr. Representative Matthews to get back. It speeds up the process, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Representative Matthews?
Excused.
Representative Clay?
Aye.
Representative Wingard?
No.
Vice Chair Widener?
Excused.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 623, having received the required votes, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Would somebody like to carry this bill? Representative Barton, thank you. With that, I'll close work session on Senate Bill 623. Open a work session on Senate Bill 203, please. 203A, excuse me. Victoria, please give us a brief summary of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 203A makes Oregon lien law consistent with Construction Contractors Board statutes by establishing the same threshold requirement of $2,000 for a written contract and providing the information notice to owner about construction liens, increases renewal period for an expired license, and authorizes CCB to sanction exempt independent contractors who hire employees. Deletes requirement that written residential contracts contain a summary of notice and eliminates contradictory language. This bill was voted out of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation unanimously and passed the floor of the Senate 2802.
Thank you. And we have a few amendments to this bill that have been presented, I believe. Or do we?
One.
No. One amendment.
Is that
Can you give us a brief description of that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You should have in front of you the -A3 amendments, which allow residential contractors to work on commercial projects if the value does not exceed $100,000. If you'll recall, this is similar language to that which the committee addressed in House Bill 2519, except at that time the limit was $250,000.
Thank you. And I'm going to go ahead and allow Mr. Cafori to come up and talk about that particular amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Member of the committee, my name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here representing the Oregon Remodelers Association. I appreciate the courtesy of the chair allowing me to present the amendments. As you recall, when we heard this bill before, there was some concern by some of the members of the committee that the bill was too broad, and so I went to the individual members who expressed those concerns and drafted amendments that met those concerns. One committee member asked specifically to have this exemption apply only to remodeling and not to new construction. The amendment does that. It reduces the $250,000 to $100,000. As you recall, the people who testified here all had small projects that they were doing. And that also, there was one member of the committee was concerned about structural elements that might be involved, and so I specifically exempted any structural amendments or any seismic amendments. And I had that drafted, that part drafted by Greg Craig Smith from the Construction Contractors Board to make sure that that definition was a workable definition. So with that, with those amendments, Mr. Chair, I think what my amendments would do would be, I think, what I heard the committee say, and that was they had some concerns for the small contractor. They didn't want the small contractors to be doing big things, but they did think it was all right for these small projects. Someone has a windstorm and the siding is blown off a commercial building. Somebody can put the siding back on, or somebody can do a small project inside a warehouse, put a sink in or something without having to get a commercial contract license. These people don't do this a lot. They do it once in a while. But especially in rural areas, there may be a problem getting a commercial contractor to come over and do a little project like this. This would allow it. That's my testimony, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I know we had you had a similar amendment before this committee that the committee decided not to act on, and so this is a scaled down version of that same amendment. So are there any questions of Mr. Cafori? I'm not seeing any at this time. I appreciate your position on this and I understand it, but I'm going to want to listen to another side of the story, if you
will. Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I know there's a couple other gentlemen in the audience who may want to speak to this particular amendment on the bill.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is John Rakowitz. I'm here representing Associated General Contractors of Oregon. And our position on this amended scaled-down version, as the chair put it, is the same as our position on 2519, considered by this committee a few weeks ago, and that is we oppose it. And overall, the reason is this remains an undermining of the raising and standard of practice that this committee worked so hard on, so long on, with huge number of stakeholders over a period of 2 years. An example and why we believe it undermines it, let's take a $600,000 project out there, and all you'd have to do is break it into six or seven subcontracts, and suddenly you have a large project being worked on by folks folks without the same bonds, without the same education requirements, and in our view, that undermines the whole purpose of the licensure that was put together. I was not around for that. There was, a 2.5-year process. It was highly negotiated. Everybody was at the table, and so for that reason, we really believe it undermines that law. At a technical level, we've conferred with our board counsel, and there are a number of technical issues associated with this amendment as well. For instance, there are no real definitions for remodel or renovation in the new language, so the interpretation of that would be hard to define as it's currently written. Secondly, it's unclear whether the definitions they've used from seismic and structural are appropriate construction terms. When you get into this, it sounds technical. It actually has huge application when you're talking structural versus non-structural sorts of construction work. In conclusion, I think what's important for our membership, I receive probably one call a week, sometimes a little bit more, of contractors in our own members, among our own membership. We have 1,100 members of all sizes and shapes, from subs to generals, all sorts of specialties, and sometimes they're not all that pleased that they've had to step up and increase their own bonding, their own anything. And once I explain to them, generally speaking, they understand what we've done here with this law and the legislature worked so hard on, is, and all the stakeholders have, is increase the standards of the industry. We've protected the owners and protected the public with this new standard. This would create an exemption to that that I think is substantial enough that it does a real undermining. Finally, I want to address the issue I think of, is this cost prohibitive to smaller contractors? That's a fair question. If you were to secure the second license bond, which would be required to do the kind of work that this exemption would allow residential contractors not to do, in the worst case scenario, for the least qualified contractor with the least experience, it could be up to $1,000 in a 2-year period. For the more experienced contractor, it would be substantially less. There are continuing education requirements expected of commercial contractors. They would also have to do that as well. So there are a number of additional measures they have to take to meet the current standards, and it is our view that this just really sort of begins the undermining. It creates confusion out there, and for that reason, we are opposed to these amendments.
Thank you. Go ahead if you'd like to make a comment.
Yes, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Brian Krieg. Today I'm here representing the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors National Association and also the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. We have several hundred members between us and employ over 5,000 skilled tradesmen. We are also in opposition basically on the same grounds as we were to the original Bill 2519. The legislation that this would amend was a great act of work between many, many different trades, contractor organizations, union, non-union, large, small, and other supplier types of organizations in there to try and make some definitions and make sure that we were putting in place training and standards for our industry. At the time that we were coming together on that, our industry was beset with many different problems out there that were affecting consumers. Mold, EFAS, other issues out there were going on, and we knew that we needed to clean up the industry and we needed to set standards out there. The standards that we were setting in that were for competency, safety, consumer protections, and training issues. Changing the dollar amounts on this and trying to make some vague descriptions that limit the type of work still doesn't really change the nature of this particular bill, and that it will water down what we were able to do during the last session on that. If you want to be a commercial contractor, it's not that difficult to become one if you're going to actually step up to the plate and do the right things. As John has mentioned, the cost factors aren't all that high. Taking the test, getting the bonding, doing the right trainings, and getting to know the codes that are affected in the commercial environment, which are different than the residential codes, is very, very important. Just coming in without knowledge of some of that information you can do the wrong thing. Our contractors are beginning to see, because we're still in the transition zone on this, out at the moment on some of our work sites, they're starting to see mixed crews coming in that are residential in nature, and they're working on the same job sites as our crews are, because the contracts are broken up into different segments. And what we're finding is that the safety qualifications of the folks we're working with is not at our level, and that is one of the most important things is when we go out on a job site, we want to make sure that everybody comes home safe, and not just our guys, but the other guys. And we don't feel that we should be put in a situation where we're working with people who have not been trained to the, you know, at least the base minimum standards on that. Many of our members are small employers. Most of my plumbing contractors are 4 to 5 person member shops. They are commercial contractors, and many of them actually go all the higher to the higher levels of saying that they're going to be a general commercial contractor and not just a subcontractor level. So, as I would say, going back to this, it's very important. There was a lot of groups involved with this. This amendment has come up very quickly at a point in time here where we haven't had a chance for even further discussion with any of the other groups, and I know that quite a few of the trade folks are away this week at their national convention. There would be other people here testifying otherwise.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Any questions? Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for not being able to track you folks completely. I'm not as conversant with the issues as you are. Are you in opposition to the amendments or to Senate Bill 203?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I should clarify that. We are in opposition to the Dash 3 amendments. The bill is fine.
You support the bill?
We support the bill, yes.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, Representative Cohen, I haven't even read the bill. We have no position on the bill, but to clarify, my opposition is strictly to the amendments.
To the Dash 3
amendments that were just read into the record. I haven't even read the bill. This came up very suddenly. I haven't looked at it closely at all.
Thank you. And I appreciate you coming forward and providing your testimony on the Dash 3 amendment to the bill, which is really about a whole different subject matter than the Dash 3 amendment. And the committee, we are actually awaiting another amendment to Senate Bill 203. And so as such, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 203A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 973A. Victoria, would you like to give us a brief summary of Senate Bill 973A?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 973A revises life settlement insurance regulations, prohibits stranger-originated life insurance practice or plan, defines parameters and reporting requirements for life settlement providers, brokers, producers, and agents, requires specified disclosures to policy owner at the time of the contract signing, and to life settlement purchasers, prohibits life settlement contracts for 5 years after issuance of policy with exceptions, prohibits certain solicitations, and adds regulations and restrictions on advertising of life settlement contracts and related products. Grants Department of Consumer and Business Services rulemaking authority, makes violation of Life Settlement Contracts Act an unlawful trade practice, prohibits person convicted of felony involving dishonesty or breach of trust from engaging in business of life settlements, requires persons engaged in life settlement business to inform DCBS of suspected fraud. This bill was voted out of the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs 4-1, passed the Senate 27-3.
Thank you.
Am I being presumptuous?
Well, first up, we have Senator Bonamici. Thank you. Maybe you can cheer this committee up with an interesting bill.
I'll do my best, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Suzanne Bonamici. I represent Senate District 17, which is Northwest Portland and Northeast Washington County, and I'm very proud to be here today in support of a bill that I'm sponsoring, Senate Bill 973A. And this bill, as your committee administrator told you, it received 27 aye votes on the Senate floor, and we had a great discussion in the Senate Consumer Protection Committee about this bill. Now, Senate Bill 973 is going to update Oregon statutes to give us the strongest law in the nation to protect vulnerable senior citizens, and these are typically over 70 years of age who are being subject to an emerging financial abuse known as stranger-originated life insurance. And this is a practice where speculators circumvent something called an insurable interest requirement. An insurable interest requirement is something that was established years and years ago, probably centuries ago, to make sure that there's a relationship between the person who's insured and the person taking out the insurance. And there is that doctrine now in Oregon law, as is true in laws across the country. Under existing law here in Oregon, a person who buys life insurance on another person needs to have an insurable interest in that person. You wouldn't want somebody to go take out an insurance policy on somebody they didn't know and then have that incentive for them to leave this world in a more expeditious fashion than they would under natural circumstances. So what happens under STOLI, this stranger-originated life insurance, and I'm going to abbreviate and call it STOLI, not to be confused with the alcoholic drink. Under the STOLI scheme, what happens is there's a disinterested investor, and that disinterested investor has a financial interest in the more rapid death of the senior citizen. So the sooner the senior citizen dies, the greater the profit for the investors. I see Representative Gilliam's paying attention now. Glad I got your attention.
Thank you.
So what happens in this bill, Senate Bill 973, is it's updating Oregon's current statute regarding something called viatical or life settlement agreements. And those were put in place in the 1990s and in response to for the AIDS crisis, for example, when people who had life insurance policies that they had taken out realized that they needed the money from those policies now rather than after they died because they had significant medical expenses. So those provisions authorize certain terminally ill patients to sell their life insurance policies to a third party for a percentage of the benefit in order to get the cash that they need to pay those medical bills. So what happens in these STOLI transactions, it's different from those because these STOLI transactions deal with somebody who's disinterested, an investor who takes out the policy. And this bill contains key provisions of two model laws. Here's where it came from. There's two sort of model laws on this issue. And both of them were approved by the organizations that wrote those provisions without dissenting vote. There's the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, NAIC, and there's also something called NCOIL, which I have learned is the National Conference of Insurance Legislators. So there are two different sort of model bills, and 973 is a hybrid. It takes the best of both of those. And I submit that this bill will be effective in combating STOLI here in Oregon because it is the best of both of those. So it includes targeted provisions addressing the most egregious acts of speculation with the key anti-fraud provisions. Now, I really want to emphasize that under this bill, under Senate Bill 973, it's still possible to sell a life insurance policy. This bill does not end that possibility. What it does is it adds important consumer safeguards, provisions that protect the privacy of seniors' financial information, disclosure requirements, and regulation of settlements when they're bundled as investments. Sometimes those are called death bonds. So to deter the manufacturing of these new policies that are designed for the STOLI market, this bill contains a carefully crafted, limited 5-year settlement waiting period on certain transactions if they have three characteristics. So typically there's a 2-year waiting period. Under these transactions, there will be a 5-year settlement waiting period. But in order for that 5-year period to take effect, there have to be three things. First, there has to be a non-recourse premium loan. And what that basically means, or the bottom line is that means somebody else is paying the premiums. The second indicator is that the investors have performed a life expectancy evaluation. Now, it's my understanding, and believe me, there's people here who know a lot more about this particular aspect than about the bill than I do. They do a life expectancy evaluation because what they're looking for is that, for them, sort of the perfect target is a senior who's going to live for exactly the right amount of time and then die so they can get their money. So they do a life expectancy evaluation. And the third trigger is an evaluation of future life settlement values. And this sort of indicates that the true purpose is to sell the policy to investors, and that violates Oregon's insurable interest law. So if you're following along with my written testimony, I'm going to go away from that for just a minute and tell you, when I first started looking into this issue, when I was Googling Stolle and that kind of thing, I found a really interesting story about Larry King, the TV guy with the suspenders, that he actually got involved in one of these transactions. And part of the problem is that when somebody else is paying the for millions of dollars, I see Representative Barton is surprised by that, because I think Larry King's probably pretty savvy, but he got involved in one of these transactions. And some of the things that happen are when, for example, somebody else is paying the premiums, that's actually taxable income to the person for whom they're paying. So first of all, they have a tax liability that they weren't aware of. Also, it can affect their ability to get insurance that they want to use for their own family. So if somebody takes out $5 million of insurance on Larry King, for example, and then he wants to go get his own policy, and that's going to go to the benefit of the investors, and he wants to go get another policy that protects his own family members, and they may say, well, you've sort of reached your maximum amount of insurance that you can get. So that's just a little side story about how this has become something that we really need to pay attention to. So I want to go back and say that those fraud indicators, if those are missing, there's no five-year waiting period. So if the senior pays the premium, there's no five-year waiting period. And there are also several exceptions. So right now we have the five-year waiting period if those three indicators are there. But there are also several exceptions, and these are in Section 14 of the bill. And this deals with, for example, what if there's a chronic or terminal illness? What if the spouse dies, or if there's a divorce or disability or bankruptcy? Those are exceptions to the five-year waiting period. So I believe that there are more than adequate protections there to protect against fraud, but also to allow sale of the policy if those circumstances, those life change circumstances, are present. So Senate Bill 973 also defines Stolle, makes that a fraudulent act. It adds transparency by requiring life settlement providers to report information to the insurance commissioner, because we really need to be paying attention to what's going on in these transactions. Prohibits a person from issuing, soliciting, marketing, or otherwise promoting the purchase of an insurance policy for the purpose of settling that policy. And that's where we run into that issue of life insurance is supposed to protect the beneficiaries. It's not supposed to be something where investors can profit from the early demise of our seniors. It also prohibits abusive premium financing agreements, and other people will explain that to you. With these protections, Oregon's anti-Stolle law will become the strongest in the nation and will stop these transactions while preserving the lawful use of life settlements. So, Mr. Chair and Committee, this is really an unsavory scheme that's going on here with people looking for seniors, sort of calculating when they're going to die, taking insurance policies out on them, and then having that money go to investors instead of to the families of the seniors. This provides huge payouts, but it's not to the families or the spouses or the loved ones. It's to investors. So this bill, Mr. Chair and Committee, is supported by AARP Oregon, the National Association of Insurance Federations, Insurance Agents, Financial Advisors around the state, by the American Council of Life Insurance Member Companies, Standard M Financial, State Farm, Nationwide, Farmers, MetLife, and many, many others who do business in the state. Mr. Chair, Committee, I respectfully request that you send Senate Bill 973A to the House floor with the due pass recommendation. And one more comment. I know there will be some discussion about potential amendments. Mr. Chair and Committee, I want to let you know that this bill was very carefully drafted. It took a long time with the people I was working with from the American Council of Life Insurers. They worked very closely with the insurance division. They spent a lot of time carefully drafting this bill. That being said, it is a lengthy bill, and I'm sorry that the length of my testimony is sort of reflective of the voluminous bill. It is a lengthy bill, and it's my understanding that the insurance administrator has identified a couple of technical things that will need to get fixed. And then there was one more issue that I agree. There's use of the word Medicaid on page 11. It's my understanding that there's some models that use public benefits instead of Medicaid, and I certainly would be agreeable to, if you so choose, to amend the bill, Mr. Chair. I think it's okay the way it it is, but if you so choose to amend the bill, changing Medicaid to public assistance and then also incorporating the technical amendments, which may avoid confusion in the future. And I'd be happy to answer questions that you may have, although I'm sure there are others much more qualified than I am to answer if they're technical. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Before I move on to a couple of questions, I do know there are several people with several amendments, and we are going to listen to those, for due process, and some may have merit and some may not. I hope that you stay engaged with some of those potential amendments, because I believe some may be good and thought well of by this committee, and some may not. So I hope
I
to keep you engaged in this conversation as much as we can.
I will do my best, Mr. Chair, to
I know
to keep
time
engaged
time
in the
is tough. Representative Tomei, a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So thanks again, Senator, for bringing this to us. It's a fascinating issue. But I had a couple of questions, especially when you talked about Larry King. So my two questions are, do you mean that a perfect stranger bought an insurance policy on him, probably for big bucks, without his knowledge? Is that true?
Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, it's not done without his knowledge. Typically what happens is that this is, and other people will expand on the details, but it is done with a knowledge of the senior. But I don't know what the representations are that are made during the sale of the product, but it's typically done with the knowledge of the senior.
Okay, thanks for clarifying that. Follow-up. And then there is an income tax issue that comes with that. Since somebody else is paying for that premium, then the person who's being insured, Larry King in this case, he would have had to pay income tax on, theoretically, what he would have had to pay for that insurance.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, that is my understanding. There are tax implications, because that amount of money that's being paid on behalf of the senior is under federal tax laws, but please do not interpret this as tax advice, is taxable income.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator, thank you for, we've been spending a lot of quality time together. It's been a pleasure. So first of all, thank you for bringing this bill forward. This has been actually really one of the more interesting bills I've run into, certainly the second half of the session. And both the proponents and opponents of this bill, I've really enjoyed learning about this. 3 weeks ago, I'd never heard about STOLE. Granted, I was a happier person then. But nonetheless, I've really enjoyed this process. My question is, let's assume, and I have a sense that there is some consensus around ending at a minimum certain practices, but I'm wondering why the belt and suspenders approach. Why do we need both the NCOIL and the NAIC approach, in which yields, say, a 27-page bill, instead of, for example, Washington's bill, which just, I believe, is the NCOIL approach only, or modification thereof. I'm wondering why we need both.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barton, I believe that this bill uses the best approaches from both of those rather than one or the other. And I certainly don't think that the length of the bill should be intimidating. I think it has provisions that are necessary for disclosure and for protection. There are many bills that we have, Mr. Chair, and committee that are lengthy, and it depends on, of course, the quality of the bill, not the quantity. So that's my response.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We will try to stay in touch with you as this bill proceeds.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Well, I think it's appropriate next that we hear from the Insurance Division. Teresa Miller.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
For the record, my name is Teresa Miller. I'm the acting administrator of the insurance division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And quite frankly, I usually end up going first on these bills, so I'm used to explaining them. And after listening to Senator Bonamici, I'm not sure I have too much to add. I think she actually did a very eloquent and articulate job of describing the bill and what it does. I think the points that I would just like to highlight, I agree with Senator Bonamici that I do think it's important to point out that this legislation really is targeted at STOLE transactions, and I don't believe it interferes with a consumer's ability to sell his or her life insurance policy, so long as that policy was not initiated for the benefit of a third-party investor. And I think the bill, as Senator Bonamici indicated, does a very good job of separating the two. Let's see. As you have heard, and Senator Bonamici discussed, there are a couple different model laws. There's the NAIC model law and the NCOIL model law. And then there are states who have approached this with the hybrid approach, which is, I think, similar to Senate Bill 973. The NAIC model restricts the sale of life policies where the transaction exhibits the characteristics of STOLE for a period of 5 years and then simply places a two-year restriction on other life settlement transactions. And both the NCOIL model and Senate Bill 973 specifically prohibit STOLE transactions and place a two-year restriction on the sale of other life insurance policies. And as Senator Bonamici indicated, both models, as well as Senate Bill 973, provide exceptions to the two-year waiting period where the insured experiences a change of circumstance, such as divorce, retirement, terminal illness, bankruptcy, death of a spouse, etc. The department has noted an increase in telephone inquiries regarding life settlement activities, and we're seeing more advertisements on the internet and direct mail marketing encouraging people to sell insurance policies to life settlement companies. As more and more people are approached to enter into these types of transactions, we believe the need increases for better disclosure and consumer protection standards to prevent fraud and abuse that may result from these transactions. Senate Bill 973 contains valuable safeguards and protects consumers in a number of ways, including giving consumers a free look period that allows consumers to rescind the transaction and requires that important disclosures be made to consumers. Senate Bill 973 represents an effective approach to the issue of addressing STOLE transactions, and I believe the approach protects seniors and other vulnerable people targeted by such transactions, but preserves the ability of consumers to enter into legitimate financial or estate planning arrangements, which may include some form of life settlement agreement. And as the senator indicated, we had talked to proponents as well as Senator Bonamici about a couple of technical amendments that I think just address conflicts with or potential conflicts with existing law. And they're fairly straightforward. Section 8.3 deals with or addresses in existing law, talks about a 30-day rescission period, and part of the new language talks about a 60-day rescission period. And so I think we just need to clarify so that we don't have a conflict in existing law there. And the second technical amendment I think that we would offer to the committee is related to Section 18 sub 3, which deals with a private right of action. And we just want to make sure that it doesn't conflict with the existing statute around contestability so that someone would not be able to sue for rescission beyond that current two-year contestability period. So, again, very technical, just making sure that there's no conflict with existing statute. And with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Miller, so you went on your two technical amendments.
Sorry, did I go too fast?
You did. Sorry, Section 8.3. Mm-hmm. Can you run that? Just walk me through those two again.
Sure.
And
I apologize, I have the original Senate Bill 973, so...
I see.
I'm sorry, I left my other one at the office. So Senate Bill, or Section 8, sub 3.
We have one for you here.
He's on our page 9.
Your page 9, okay. Section 8 sub 3, if you look at the line 4, it talks about the ability of the certificate holder to rescind the contract not later than the 30th day after the date on which the contract is executed or not later than the 15th day after the policyholder receives the life settlement proceeds. That actually conflicts with sections, let's see, the 60-day period was in... It's in some of the disclosures.
Yeah.
Let's see. If you look at page 15, line 36, it talks about all life settlement contracts entered into an estate must provide the owner with an absolute right to rescind the contract before the earlier of 30 days and then, or 60 days and then 30 days. So I think we just have a conflict with 30 and 15 and 60 and 30. So we would propose just making that 60. And then section 18, sub 3, is the second issue. Sub 3 talks about a person damaged by the acts of a person in violation of any provision of ORS 744319 to 744358 may bring a civil action against the person committing the violation of a court of competent jurisdiction. And I think here we're dealing with the fact that we can have somebody bring a civil action. I think typically this would be an action to rescind the contract because of fraud or whatever. And we just want to make sure that that's something that can only happen within the two-year contestability period, which is the case today. We don't want this to eliminate the contestability period. Today you have this contestability period where for fraud, misrepresentation, or material omission, the insurer can sue to rescind for 2 years. But after that two-year period, they're no longer allowed to rescind. And we just want to make sure this didn't open up that contestability period. And I don't think that was the intent mm-hmm. of the proponents.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Like many things that have come before this committee, I am now in an entirely new world that I didn't even know existed, and I'd never heard of a STOLI before in my life, so I'm struggling to keep up. And I think it's easy to look at the what just doesn't seem right to most of us. I guess I just want to make sure in full disclosure or whatever else, there are actually advantages to the elderly individual who might wish to enter into one of these agreements. They do, in fact, receive cash settlement for making this agreement, do they not?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cowan, if you're talking about the STOLI transaction itself, so you're not talking about...
Yeah, at least that's the way I think I understand them.
And in a STOLI transaction, you're right. The consumer would generally receive some sort of cash payment for entering into this. I think one of the problems with STOLI is that the whole purpose behind the STOLI transaction is to really evade the insurable interest law. So I guess it becomes a policy question about whether or not you think insurable interest laws are a good thing. But the whole purpose behind the STOLI transaction is really to get around that because they wouldn't be able to get a policy on this individual without sort of evading those laws.
I guess I first of all I want to clarify that I'm not supporting that particular concept, but it isn't like we target elderly people and they get nothing in return, so there is that consideration. But the life settlement process is a way for individuals who might wish to turn over some assets because they have a need for ready cash at some point in time. And I guess I want to make sure that we aren't jeopardizing that at the same time that we try to do the right thing. So your read of this is that the bill itself would not impact the current life settlement options that individuals have for selling their existing policies. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cowan, correct. This bill, I think, is really targeted at STOLI transactions. So for somebody who went out, bought a life insurance policy, and then years later decided that they just didn't need the policy for whatever reason and wanted to sell it, I don't believe this bill would be a problem for that individual at all. If they entered into the settlement or into the policy with the idea that they were going to sell it, I think that's where you have concerns, and that's where this bill addresses it.
I think that may just be something that many individuals are not aware of being an option for them at a point in time when they may need to turn some of their assets into mm-hmm. a more liquid form. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
yes, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Miller. I appreciate you.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Winger, I didn't see you. Excuse me.
Thank you. Teresa, I have a couple of questions on some phrases that have been used here. I'm trying to distinguish in my mind the difference between a life settlement and a stole. Other than perhaps the timing of when it occurs. So my first question is, the phrase is used in your testimony that the person who arranges the stole with the elderly individual has a financial interest in the death of the insured. Doesn't the life settlement company that we're putting on the angel side of this lever also have a financial interest in the death of the insured?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, if I can go back to your first question, if that's okay. I mean, I think the issue is the intent at the time the person enters into the contract. So a life settlement agreement where the person, when they entered into the contract, was to have beneficiaries, their family, benefit their family if they die, protect people. That's not the issue. The issue is at the time that they're entering into that contract, is their intent to actually protect their beneficiaries, or is the intent to basically sell the policy to investors? And I think investors certainly have, at that point, they're the owners of the policy. Once it's turned over to them, they have an interest then in the owner dying or the person who took the policy out dying.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Yeah, I guess I didn't phrase my question the right way. It certainly makes sense to me that the folks who do stoles have a financial interest in the death of the insured. But I'm asking, don't the life settlement companies also, by the nature of the transaction they're entering into with the elderly person, have a financial interest in the death of the insured?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, I think that's true.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
The other phrase that was used here was insurable interest, that as a policy matter, we generally, it sounds to me like what we're saying is that we generally have a policy interest in wanting the person who would benefit to have an insurable interest. And so we tend to think of that as family members or you know, someone who's connected to them, and that one of the things that I'm hearing makes a stole kind of a negative is that they don't necessarily have an insurable interest from a policy standpoint. Don't the life settlement companies also fall into that category of not necessarily having an insurable interest in that they are not related to the person being insured? I guess I'm trying to figure out what is the difference in the policy. I see why we might want to limit insurance and the beneficiaries to people who are related to them, but we're carving out an exemption for life settlement companies, apparently, and I'm trying to distinguish between them and stoles on this issue of insurable interest.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winger, I'm not sure I understand that carving out the exemption for life settlement companies.
Well, again, you were suggesting that we have a policy interest in limiting who takes out insurance on somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And the phrase was used, insurable interest.
Mm-hmm.
What is the difference between the life settlement company and the stole company when it comes to this issue of insurable interest?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, I'm not sure I'm understanding where you're going, so I'm not sure I understand how to answer the question. I'm sorry.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is it seems like both companies are in the business of, or both business models are basically premised on the idea of buying an older person's life insurance policy and making the payments and giving them cash up front in return for that. And I'm trying to figure out why one is a policy good and the other is a policy bad.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winger, I think that gets back to your original question, which is what's the difference between stole or some other legitimate life settlement? And again, I think that the difference is what was the intent at the time the policy was taken out?
One more question, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, please.
I guess what I mean by this is I'm trying to look at it from a customer's standpoint. And in both cases, they're seeking to get some money up front based on a life insurance. And they're essentially entering into a business contract that is based on their death. And it has nothing to do with their, you know, their children or anybody else being beneficiaries. They're looking for some cash up front.
and selling a life insurance policy on their death. And I'm trying to figure out what the policy difference is between the life settlement company that does that because they happen to have owned the life insurance policy for a while versus the Stoli company that simply comes to them and says, even though you don't happen to currently have a life insurance policy, if you did, we could enter into a transaction in which you'd get money up front. I'm still trying to figure out what the difference is here from the customer standpoint, the older person who may be looking for a financial transaction in which they come into some money before they're dead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingert, I think it really does come down to a policy issue about life insurance and the whole idea of insurable interest. And Oregon, just as many states, has decided insurable interest is something that's important in life insurance. So you can't just go take out a life insurance policy on somebody else. And so there is, I think, a real difference in when you enter into that transaction. Did you enter into it with insurable interest, or did somebody else come approach you to enter into it? And I believe there's a real difference between those two. One, you're taking out a policy to protect your family. That's kind of the idea of life insurance. The other, somebody's approaching you, offering you money to go do something that you could legally do, only that person couldn't legally take a policy out on your life, so they get you to do the same thing. I think the other thing, and I mentioned briefly the disclosures, and Senator Bonamici also talked about the fact that, I mean, there are tax implications, and I think a lot of times those implications are not necessarily explained to the consumer. And so they see this free cash, they see all this these great benefits, and they don't understand that they may be taxed on those, that the free insurance may have taxable consequences for them. And so the disclosure pieces, I think, are something that we actually feel are important for that reason.
One final follow-up. I take your point on the issue of insurable interest, and I also take your point about the tax liabilities. I still haven't heard you make a real distinction between a life settlement company and a Stoli on either of those issues, insurable interest or there might be some tax liabilities involved.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingert, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to convince you then. I mean, I think it really is at the time you take out that policy, what was your intent? And if insurable interest isn't important to you, it may not.
However, the policy, when we're talking about when you actually enter the transaction, there's really no difference between the two, is there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Warrior, it's really when you take out that initial policy, that's what we're talking about.
But when we go to sell it to somebody, there really is no difference between these two, is there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, I suppose that's correct. Again, it goes back to the intent when you enter into it. And if your intent was then to sell it, that's different than not having the intent to sell it at the time you enter.
Thank you.
Great subject matter. Teresa, when I have just one question for you. So a settlement company, when you take out a life insurance policy, its purpose is, you know, to ensure your life, to provide some benefit when you die to some beneficiary.
Typically.
And so you usually do that. In a Stoli arrangement, it doesn't seem that that's really the intent of that, except that unless you consider the beneficiary the life settlement company that's presenting this to you as being the beneficiary, I guess. So it seems more like it's an investment vehicle, not really a life insurance policy. I mean, to me, that seems like a fundamental difference in the purpose of life insurance, I guess.
Mr. Chair, you just, I think, answered Representative Wingard's question much better than I did. I think that's exactly right. I think there's just a fundamental difference in the purpose.
Thank you, Chair. Just one more time on this, though.
Representative Wingard, one more follow-up, and I think Representative Burton had something to say here.
If we're having a policy discussion about whether or not people should simply have insurance to benefit their benefit, you know, their legitimate beneficiaries, I can understand that. But if we can think of a reason why somebody should be able to sell that to get the cash up front, then I don't see the difference between the fact that it was a policy that they originally took out to benefit others and then made a decision to sell on the market, and that they just take it out to sell it on the market. I mean, if we want to limit insurance to simply your beneficiaries, we can do that. But I'm still not understanding the difference between a life settlement company and a Stoli if the issue is we want people to have insurance simply for their beneficiaries.
Understood. Very, very good point. Representative Burton.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to have to pass. I think we're just belaboring the point.
I believe so, too. And I've got a lot of people left to testify.
The recent cross-examination, what it lacked in clarity, I think it made up for into sheer aggression.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. We'll move on. John Mangum and Todd Thacker. And thank you. And I know we've been moving really slow, so I'm going to depend on you to make your points concise and so I can get through the rest of the folks. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Mangan. I'm Regional Vice President for the American Council of Life Insurers, and we represent approximately 300 life insurance companies that are licensed in Oregon. Provide about $50 billion of investment in the state and many billions of dollars in annual benefits. And, of course, we have lots of employees here in the state and a long history, and we are actually around for the original debate on viatical settlements, which I'd like to talk about it because I think it will perhaps clarify Representative Wingard's questions. First of all, I wanted to compliment Senator Bonamici on putting this bill together. This bill, frankly, reflects the best instincts of Oregon. As a person growing up in this state, we were used to the legislature taking lead on key consumer issues, and we think this bill puts Oregon at the forefront of what is a national debate to try to protect seniors from a growing abuse while not at all affecting the legitimate sale of a life insurance policy that's legitimately obtained and therefore that someone had insurable interest in at the time they bought it. And we'll try to explain how that works a little bit, and then I'm happy to answer some questions. The key difference here is that every life insurance contract must have insurable interest in order for it to be a contract. So at the inception, if you don't have that insurable interest, that is, an interest in the continuing life of the person that's being insured, then you don't have the insurable interest and you don't have a contract. You shouldn't have a contract because the purpose of life insurance is to protect someone from an untimely death. It's an interest in the continued life of a human being. And because of that, it does differ from other assets and investments. And this is verified and actually become part of our federal law through congressional enactments. What Congress has said is if you have insurable interest, then the life insurance contract becomes a social compact, a social benefit that benefits you, your family, your small business, your family farm, and therefore it receives special protection and special benefits, such as the fact that your cash value that's building up in your policy is treated as a tax-deferred earning. And the biggest benefit, which is that the death benefit, is treated as tax-free to the widow, to the orphan, to the family, to the small business, perhaps even to a charity. So the fact that it's a social compact and a social product and has that benefit attached to it means that it's different than just a plain old asset. Now, once you purchase a life insurance policy and you have insurable interest in it, I can assure you that you have certain rights and you have a certain property that's of value to you. Currently, we estimate there are about 1 million life insurance contracts in effect in Oregon. Many of those were purchased, half a century ago, and then they've been purchased every year since then. And virtually all of those are completely exempt from anything that's happening in this bill related to STOLI, because they were purchased with people's money. Real people bought them for a real purpose. They had insurable interest, and as such, they're not subject to any extra waiting period in terms of how they sell it. It is a property right that they own. And if at some point, like my mother, who's 83, who bought her last policy when she was 67 to help cover an estate tax, she's had it for obviously a long period of time. If she wanted to sell it to somebody, she could for cash. That's a possibility. Nothing in this bill restricts her from doing that. Or frankly, she has all the rights attached to that policy that currently exist in it. For instance, she could take a loan on her current cash value, which frankly right now is a much better deal because she has about half the policy value in cash, and she can take a loan off that any time to pay for any kind of hardship expense. And believe me, she's doing that right now because she needs the money. Or she could sell it in the free market and get an offer from a legitimate life settlement company that does buy policies that are no longer needed. Now, you'll have to ask the settlement folks, what's the average purchase price of a policy like that?
But according to the data that I've read, it's approximately currently about 5 to 8 cents on the dollar for the death benefit, whereas my mom's cash value is much higher than that, so she could probably, she'd be better off keeping her policy. In addition, most life insurance contracts in Oregon since the mid-90s, when this was first offered as a viatical settlement option, include something called an accelerated benefit. And that, what that is a recognition. During the AIDS crisis, this viatical settlement possibility was opened up, and it allowed people to sell a policy to a stranger, really for the first time in Oregon, if they were terminally ill, had 2 years or less to live. And that was, we thought, a legitimate reason, a legitimate hardship that would, frankly, be an exception to the previous rule, which is, no, you can't really sell your policy to a stranger. So that was opened up in the mid-90s to allow the terminally ill to get some cash they could use before they died. In response to that, life insurance companies came up with an accelerated benefit, which allows a policy owner to access their death benefit in advance of their death in the same way, 50, 75, or even 100% of the total death benefit if they're terminally ill. And that offer is still out there for most policy owners. But with this bill, frankly, what this does is it expands on the current authority. The current authorization is you can only sell your policy if you're terminally ill. Now, that's what the legislature said in the mid-90s. They were very careful about expanding that right because of the issues that Representative Wingart mentioned. They did not want to create an undue interest in people's early death, but they saw a need, and they narrowed it down very carefully to terminal illness. And this bill opens up, frankly, the option for Oregonians to settle a policy if they paid their own money and if they no longer need it. So that right is being expanded. But at the same time, some very important safeguards are being put in place. Disclosure protections, privacy protections. One of the things that happens, Representative Wingard, when someone sells a policy legitimately is that it can be resold and resold many times. So you don't know who the new owner is. And the bill requires a disclosure to you of who now owns the interest in your death. We thought that was, the regulators thought that was a fair disclosure. Now, the bill also protects the privacy of information that's been collected about you and then, again, sold off to investor after investor after investor. So these protections are in the bill to try to allow people more rights but control some of the potential abuses. And I'd just like to close by saying that other states are taking strong action in this regard. Oregon's not the only one. There are currently 5 other states that have a bill very much like this. In addition, Minnesota just passed a bill very much like this, and Vermont as well. And that the trend seems to be to really understand that this is going to require some extra protection for seniors. In addition, Congress is looking at this issue now. The Senate Committee on Aging held a hearing on April 29th, and they highlighted a number of the problems in the market for life settlements. And they said we need more transparency, we need more disclosure, and we need stronger consumer protection laws, much like the ones you're considering here in Senate Bill 973. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members, I would, again, just commend this bill to you, and I hope that you'll vote for it. And if you have questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you. I'd like to hear the other testimony first before I open it up for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Todd Thacker, and I'm with Prudential Financial, and we support the bill. What I thought I would do is give a couple of real-life examples to help you see how this has worked. The first one is a Prudential example, and last year Ohio passed a bill very similar to this, to the bill here, and it was kind of a hybrid bill like it is here. And we got a policy that was submitted from Pennsylvania, and we checked it out, and we rejected the policy because the agent wasn't appointed in Pennsylvania. Well, the same policy came in 2 weeks later from California, and it was a $9.5 million policy. And so because it triggered the first time, we pulled it again, and we did some investigating, and it turns out that the owner of the policy was a 72-year-old woman who lived actually in Ohio. And she was approached by a settlement company, and because they had passed their law last year, they drove her to Pittsburgh to have her life expectancy evaluation, and they promised to give her $10,000 to $15,000 for doing the deal. She was not aware that a $9 million policy was trying to be, now we stopped it so it didn't actually get issued, that was trying to be issued on her life. It came in that her financial report as to what her net worth was filed at $12.5 million. Well, her real net worth was $2,000. And, of course, when she found out about it, she, you know, had concerns for her own safety that someone else would have this huge policy out on her life. There was a case, and I think Representative Wingard, to your point, I think the key difference is one is buying insurance for legitimate purposes and to protect your family, etc., protect the business, versus the actual manufacturing of a sale of a policy. And there was a case last fall that kind of highlight how that works. And in that case, and this came to light because one of the insurance companies tried to rescind a $3.5 million policy. But what we saw when we got behind that in that litigation was that the life settlement company got 50% of the sale, 50% of the commissions on the sale of that policy. So it was about $300,000 premium, $100,000 of the commissions went to the life settlement company. And then what they do is they finance. So again, they don't, and as the indicia of the bill would require non-premium financing so that you're not paying for it yourself, you're financing it. So the settlement company owned the bank that financed the loan, so they were getting the interest on the loan. And then the other difference is that the consumer really doesn't have a choice, because at the end of the two-year period, when the contestability period's up, usually the loans are triggered to go 24 to 26 months, which link to the contestability period. Well, I have $350,000 of premium. I'm paying 14 to 27% interest on that. The senior, at that point, they're like, oh, I'm not going to pay. They would have to pay the pay off the loan and the interest. They just take a walk on it and turn their policy over. And so really, at the end of the 2 years, the senior doesn't, who's in a STOLI deal, ends up really not having a choice but to turn the policy over because they can't afford it anyway. And if they wanted to continue policy, they would, you know, try to take a new one and not have to pay off the loan. The only other thing that I wanted to say, there was another case. This came out a couple weeks ago, $127 million on an individual in Minnesota. In Minnesota, just last week, I believe the governor signed a very similar bill to this one. And in that case, that was litigated, and insurers had come in and tried to rescind some of those policies, and they were unsuccessful in doing that. And now it comes out that this guy and the Department of Insurance there has brought an action against, because this guy had $127 million. And it just kind of highlights that this is what's going on out there. We're trying to stop it, but we, even though that one was litigated, we weren't able to stop the fraud that now the Department of Insurance has been able to investigate.
Thank you. I need to keep moving on, and I appreciate you giving us the perspective. Is there any questions?
I do have questions, Mr. Chair.
I bet you do. Representative Wingard, a question.
Todd, that first example where they had grossly exaggerated the woman's net worth, is that not insurance fraud?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
Okay, thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
But they're coming in under a STOLI to do it.
One question, one follow-up.
Well, I guess it's for both of you gentlemen. Again, what is the insurable interest that a life settlement company has?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, I think Ms. Miller was trying to distinguish between the two pieces. At the moment, and at when you take out a new policy, you need to have insurable interest in order to effectuate a contract. That's in the law, that's in common law, that's in congressional law. So that's critical. Now what happens is, after you've owned the policy, you bought it for legitimate reasons, and you had insurable interest at the time you bought it, and you've been sitting on it for years and years, like your grandmother or whoever, for many years, it is an asset. And I think what's happened in the marketplace is that states have allowed the sale of that policy because there was originally insurable interest. They allow for the sale of it into the free market with certain protections. And originally, it was really only if you were terminally ill. And now I think the market has evolved and people are selling them and buying them in an open market, but only if the policy had insurable interest to begin with. Because a contract without insurable interest is not a contract. It's a fraudulent contract, and there is no property right in a fraudulently obtained asset. So that's the key distinction there.
Mr. Chair, I didn't get my question answered. I'd like to ask it just one more time. What is the insurable interest that the life settlement company has once they've taken possession of that insurance policy from the original holder?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, there really isn't one after they sell it into the market. You're right. They do have an interest in the rapid demise either way, but when it's initiated without insurable interest, there is no contract.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Next up, I'd like to have Dave Fiskum and Robert Woolley. Welcome, gentlemen. If you could introduce yourself for the record and hopefully keep it short or concise.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Dave Fiskum here for Coventry. We are a leader in the life settlement market, secondary market. I'm here to do two things quickly for you. The first is to indicate for the record that we do have questions about Senate Bill 973A, and there was no chance we would contend to adequately deal with those questions in the Senate, given the very late process the Senate used to consider this bill. It was pending only 3 days before the first hearing, and then there were two hearings, and the committee acted. Senator Bonamici, to her credit, listened to us in her office talk about the issue as well as in testimony, so I don't hold any grudge against her for that. It just happened very quickly. The second thing is that I would advocate that we have a chance in Oregon to produce a better, more even-handed approach to regulate the bad actors called STOLE. We support that. We support that kind of regulation. We support what other states have done to regulate that in a more even-handed way than Senate Bill 973A does. We would ask for a chance to work with you to produce a better bill in the spirit of how consumer protection laws are crafted in Oregon with Mr. Mangan, a friend of mine for years. I've lived here all my life, and I have seen consumer protection legislation crafted in a way that was more even-handed than this bill. So with him, I share that goal. With me today, to my left, is Robert Woolley, who frankly has traveled here from Louisiana to testify before you today, and he will do a better job than me of introducing himself. So, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I will turn to him.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Robert Woolley, and I'm here on behalf of Coventry. We are a leader in the life settlement marketplace, and I will start by trying to answer Representative Wingard's question about the difference between STOLE and legitimate life settlement. Basically, STOLE is where a consumer is approached and they reach an agreement with an investor to sell the policy before it is even purchased. So that is the difference. A legitimate life settlement is the person purchased insurance for insurance purposes, and then later, because it was not performing well or they no longer needed the policy, then they went into the secondary marketplace and sold the policy. So you're right, there is no insurable interest by either, but at least in the second transaction, the original purchase was for the purpose of having insurance, whereas in the STOLE transaction, it's either advertised as free insurance because you agree the day you make the application, before you even get the policy, that you're going to sell it. So it's called manufacturing insurance, and has been a problem and does need to be addressed because it doesn't really have a place, and it takes away from the entire transaction. So I hope that might give you a better explanation, because it's that lack of insurable interest because the sale takes place before the policy is even issued. So there never really is a true owner of the policy that has insurable interest at that time. Does that help?
I'll let you continue.
So anyway, our company is in the business of purchasing policies when they're underperforming, they're no longer needed, and they do provide value to consumers. In a lot of cases, the cash values of these policies are low, and in fact, on average, our company can offer anywhere, and the entire industry can offer anywhere between 3 to 5 times that cash value if you reach a point where you would like to no longer need the policy, it's underperforming. And what will typically happen in one of these cases is in today's economy, you bought a policy, it's not performing the way it should have because there was an investment, a portion of the policy, and so you suddenly get a notice that you owe some premium. When it was sold to you, you were told that the premiums would be paid out of the dividends. And it was for a time, and then you suddenly get this notice, and so you can then go back to the company and sell it back to them for the cash value that they've agreed to at the onset of the policy, or you can go into the secondary marketplace and you can put the policy out there and ask companies to bid on it. There are disclosures that will have to be made under any law. In fact, the law that we propose would have similar disclosures to the ones that are in the law that's before you. There are advertising restrictions, the advertising to people about free insurance and things of that nature. We agree that this is a problem. Once again, we don't market even to the general public. We market to insurance professionals because that's where people are going to go with these policies. They're going to go back to an agent or someone, a financial advisor, and they're going to say, what are my options to do with this policy? And that's the way the transaction is going to occur. So we are against STOLI. We think it's wrong too. We think that it is something that is not good for the public, for the citizens of this state or this country, and so we have fought it. Now, where we differ is how we go about, regulating STOLI. And the ACLI has worked very diligently to push a 5-year ban, an indiscriminate line in time that says that you have to hold the policy for 5 years and you cannot sell it within that 5-year time frame. The in-call approach, and this is a very simplistic, just to get into the under the time constraints that we're under, very simplistic, that they have a 2-year ban, which coincides with the contestability period for a policy. In other words, if you discover fraud in the policy, it was talked about before, you have 2 years within which to do that, to set it aside as an insurer. And so we think that the in-call model, the Washington State version of the in-call model, is a better approach. And there's a whole lot of other differences with it, but it basically boils down to the 2-year, 5-year. A lot of these policies, in fact, my people tell me somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 60% of these types of policies that would be potential life settlement policies lapse within the first 5 years. And so it's an attempt to limit a portion of the marketplace. And that's why we object to it, because it indiscriminately takes people and says, we're going to treat the bad guys and the good guys all the same. The innocents and the bad people are both going to have to pay. And I guess the example to use is, if you had gone and bought a policy under this statute and you had premium financed it, legitimate premium financed, and that's another difference between the two approaches. In-call recognizes that there can be legitimate premium finance arrangements. Every premium finance arrangement doesn't mean it's a STOLI. It's only a STOLI if there's enough in the premium finance where you're never going to repay the loan, there's enough in there to fund the agreement that you agreed to give you the amount of money up front that you sold your policy for on the day you took it out. That is a STOLI premium financing arrangement. There are other legitimate ones. So what this says is, unless you pay cash for it, then you are prohibited between years 2 and 5. So if a person went premium financed it, their son comes to them, they no longer need this policy. The son says, I have a legitimate business opportunity. It's going to take a lot of money. The dad says, I can't borrow it right now. There's a credit crunch on. The son says, well, I can't borrow it either. There's a credit crunch on. He says, I've got this asset. Let me go see what it's worth so that we can take advantage of this for you. And he goes in, and because he premium financed it, now he can't even go into the life settlement marketplace for another 2 years, 3 years, whenever he decides between that 2 and 5 year period to go in and try to exercise his ability. And so he will be limited from the marketplace. If he ever went, after he purchased the policy, to an estate planner and said, I would like to have you evaluate my estate and tell me what it's worth and what I need to do, give me some advice. If you submitted the policy out into the marketplace to find out its market value in the life settlement marketplace, you now have limited yourself to between that 2 and 5. You can no longer sell that policy. So once again, it's just an indiscriminate time frame that gets the good guys and the bad guys and punishes everyone alike. And so that is the difference between the two processes that we see and that we would like to avoid. We would like for people to be able to, if they need to enter the marketplace, there's not a bunch of pitfalls and hurdles that unsuspecting people who might have a time frame, that they may need that money within that 2-year to 5-year period of time. And so they're going to be told, no, we can't do that because we're going to try to catch the bad guys. So we're just going to put everybody in the same boat and treat them that way. So we are for regulation. We just think a better approach is to look at what Washington State did, which was modeled off of the NCOL, which had the 2-year ban. I have some other comments, but I see that we're running short on time, and I really don't want to take any more time. I appreciate the opportunity to come here and talk with you about it. But I guess the point is, we're for regulation, too. And on the Larry King deal, from what I understand on the what happened there, and I'm it's been a long time since I heard about it, but apparently he had a life insurance policy and did a legitimate life settlement and made some money, a lot of money. And a broker approached him then about doing a STOLE and got him into a STOLE transaction saying, you know, if you liked your legitimate life settlement, then let's try a STOLE. And then he found out about some of these other problems that come along with STOLE, about your lack of insurability. You only have a limited amount of insurability and so on and so forth. So that's what I understand of that process. So There is a reason for a regulation. I agree with that. We just differ on how we get there. Thank you.
Thank you, and I appreciate that you've traveled here to testify on this, and you've referred to the Washington State model as being something that you see as a better approach to this issue.
Yes.
Than the one before you. And so I'm not sure whether I've looked at that Washington State model with any great scrutiny to really ferret out the differences between this bill and that bill. I think you've touched on one of them. Are there any, can you briefly just tell us specifically, or is there just so many differences that it is a different bill?
It's a lot of small differences, I guess. It's differences in language about the definition of STOLE, whether you use the word plan or agreement. Plan is a little more, I guess, objective. You know, did I plan to sell my house when I bought it? Well, yeah, one day down the road I planned to sell it, but did I have an agreement to sell it? No, that's different. And so you get down to words like that. So it's a lot of different small things. It also has to do with some of the rescission periods. They weren't expanded in the NCOL model and the Washington law. They've been doubled in the law here in Oregon. These are long transactions. They require months to complete. And so the minute you have an agreement, the money is put into an escrow so that that protects the consumer to know that the money is there that can't be touched by the company that puts it up. And then you spend the back and forth of getting the medical exam, then that is evaluated. Then there.
Bill, my point is
right.
being that there's a lot of little differences
right.
with this bill,
absolutely.
And so I don't need an explanation that's going
to. Mr. Chair, can I just make a quick comment on that point, just procedurally for the record? It's important to me to say this in a couple of regards. One, I have taken initiative to ask Legislative Council to get the Washington law put into Oregon statutory construction terms. That's been done, not proofread. I expect that will be out in a day or so in mm-hmm. time for your consideration if you choose to consider it. Secondly, I should add that in consultation with some other life settlement interests over the last few days, we have reviewed language on page 5 relative to definition of STOLE, as well as on page 17, the language that the insurance commissioner, the acting insurance commissioner, referred to. That language is in that section very complicated for me to read. For you, I suspect the same. There are double and sometimes triple negatives, which require you to do some mental gymnastics, but we have prepared draft amendments not yet at council to deal with that language in a way that deals with the points Mr. Woolley has made. So I should add one other point. I have assured Representative Riley, Mr. Chair, in your absence Friday, that we were not proposing a bunch of amendments to kill the bill. We're proposing amendments which we think will improve the method by which you would regulate STOLE and not adversely affect genuine life settlement agreements, and those amendments should be ready for you very soon. Thank you.
Thank you. Don't see any other questions at this time. I'd like to get a couple other people on the record today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate y'all's time.
It's quite apparent to me I'm not going to get through the testimony. I'm going to be carrying this bill over to Wednesday, but I will proceed with... no, here I get it. Bob Buxman, Todd York, and Bert Guptill. Welcome, gentlemen. If you identify yourselves for the record, then maybe you can do it in a couple of minutes. If you feel you need more time, I guess you'll have to come back.
We'll make it quick. I'm Bob Buxman. I'm the Executive Director for the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors for the State of Oregon.
I'm Todd York. I'm an agent here in town. I'm also a member of the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors.
I'm Bert Guptill. I'm a financial advisor. I've been doing it for 31 years, and I testified a while ago in the life insurance hearing with Mr. Riley. I'm a member of the association also, but I'm speaking for myself rather than the association.
Thank you. Go ahead and proceed.
NAEP Oregon has approximately 700 members statewide, and we insure at least 350,000 Oregon households with life insurance. As a licensed insurance agent, when I first came into the business, one of the things I was told in selling life insurance, the purpose is to provide for the families in case someone dies too young or if they live too long. It is never discussed as an investment vehicle. NAEPA Oregon is not opposed to legitimate life settlements. Our agents, in fact, will help individuals whose financial circumstances have changed to try and find the means of the best possible solution for turning their life insurance policy, either cashing it out or finding a legitimate life settlement. This is in sharp contrast, I believe, to the inappropriate and manufactured sales of insurance where settlement companies profit the sooner the insured dies. In fact, these transactions promote wagering on human life. Most applications now ask questions surrounding the intent of the insured at the time of the application. If the insured answers the question honestly, then the insurance may be declined. So if they're forced sometimes, if they're being approached on a STOLE type transaction, to be very vague or answer negatively. The insurance company, sometime in the future then, if they find out that this is in fact a STOLE transaction and based on verbal agreements, can cancel the policy or deny the death benefits altogether. In many of these cases, seniors may have signed an indemnity agreement with the settlement company, which then allows the settlement company to recover expenses under such circumstances. In addition, the closing
transaction paperwork sometimes in these transactions is almost like a closing of a mortgage loan. So we are not at all opposed to life settlements, but the STOLI transactions we believe are inappropriate for consumers in the state of Oregon.
So I assume you're speaking in favor of the bill?
In favor of the bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee, once again, I'm Todd York, and I'm an agent, and I am a member of the association, but for a moment, I just want to talk about the clients I work with. Sitting and listening to some of this testimony, I feel like a stranger in a strange land. Because like Bob said, I've been doing this for 25 years, and the whole purpose of the planning we do with our clients is to protect their families and their businesses. I've never been involved with life settlements, though I think there are some situations where those might be appropriate. However, what screams out to me about this STOLI and some of this stranger originated life insurance is ethical questions. If there was ever potential for dishonorable acts in my industry, these stranger-originated life insurance contracts. I support this bill. There need to be some controls to curtail unethical behavior. I do support the position paper that was passed out. One of the things that hasn't been addressed to a large extent is if STOLI became a commonplace method, it would drive up the cost for legitimate purchasers of life insurance. Insurance companies assume a certain amount of business is going to fall off the books. If these guys, this introduces the investor in life insurance, which should be an ethical question as well. But then the number of policies that lapse goes down. So the insurance companies are going to adjust the rates accordingly, making it unaffordable for the legitimate purchasers that I represent.
Thank you. I appreciate your brevity and right to the point.
My name's Bert Guptill. You may okay?
Yeah. Move back from the mic a little
okay,
bit.
Okay, that's better. I got the distance. Mr. Chair and Representative Cowan, my representative, Saturday was a tough day for me. I had two clients pass away, and there was one funeral in Toledo. Perhaps you knew Dick Crow, a distinguished internee in a Korean camp, and another client in the Valley. Both of them had permanent insurance, whole life insurance. The whole life insurance being tax-free started, I think it was a deal between President Woodrow Wilson when income tax was invented, and life insurance payouts, the deferral on annuities and everything to have the everyday person be able to save for retirement was held not to be a taxable event. Many, many advantages over the years. Quite frankly, I personally am against any sort of settlement on stranger-owned insurance as well as what we're talking about here today. Kind of blew that just a bit. How would you say... We're afraid in this industry, and I think I'm speaking for everybody here right now, because we're one step away from the federal government stepping in and saying, hey, life insurance is an investment. It's a way that we can pool our money and wait for people to die and get it income tax free. Think about it. There's a slippery slope being developed, and we're afraid that the everyday consumer, before we know it, with the government's lust to fill in the tax gaps, we're right in the sights of the federal government and could be on the state. I think we answered the questions for the state here a month or so ago in the hearings. But right now, any type of non-insurable interest, investing in life insurance to make a profit out of it, taking advantage of the wonderful tax-free payouts, runs the risk of hurting everybody. And so I'd love to see my state be one of the leaders in simply saying no. I think we're stuck with a certain degree of, having to put up with this, but I think saying simply no to any more stranger-owned and putting really good checks and balances on it, and not just stranger-originated, but stranger-owned, too, I would love to see that totally eliminated. It won't happen, but you have, I think, a moral duty to look at the big picture and what it means to the everyday consumer and what it means to the everyday consumer 10, 20, 30 years from now. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, very, very, very much. I appreciate your testimony here today. And with that, committee, I am going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 973A. Apologize to the three people who are regular lobbyists in the building. I am carrying over Senate Bill 973A till Wednesday, which we will pick the conversation back up. I'm also carrying over Senate Bill 929A, Senate Bill 203A, and Senate Bill 386A. Those will all be carried over till Wednesday. Committee, I'm hoping that Wednesday we will be going till 5:50 p.m. again to make up for a little lost time. And with that, I believe I'm ready to adjourn. I'll adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection. Thank you.